We will not abandon Afghanistan to a merciless enemy trying to kill its way to power.
The U.S. Defense Secretary makes a surprise visit to Afghanistan. It's Thursday, September 28th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. You'll also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, seeking better trade with China. Why Buddhist monks sometimes become violent. A cleaner way to make bricks. Turning trash into treasure. Tiny homes for the homeless. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis arrived Wednesday for an unannounced visit to Afghanistan, weeks after the White House unveiled its new strategy for the war-torn country. He was greeted with rocket fire, with an attack on the international airport killing at least one person and wounding several others. VOA's Bill Gallo is traveling with the Pentagon chief. He has this report from Kabul.
Just hours after Defense Secretary Jim Mattis arrived in the Afghan capital, a reminder of the instability that plagues the country. The Taliban claimed responsibility for an attack in which several rockets were fired toward the Kabul International Airport. Mattis's visit was meant to highlight unity in the face of the continued unrest.
We will not abandon Afghanistan to a merciless enemy trying to kill its way to power.
Coalition leaders were upbeat, saying President Donald Trump's new strategy is already having positive effects.
I welcome President Trump's new condition-based approach to Afghanistan and the region. Much progress has been made, but there is still too much violence, still too much instability, and still too much corruption.
The U.S. is sending 3,000 more troops to Afghanistan, bringing the total number of U.S. forces here to over 14,000. Trump says they won't come home until conditions on the ground warrant it. For now, that's not the case. A U.S. military official speaking on background acknowledged the conflict is still within the bounds of a stalemate. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Kabul.
President Donald Trump's Afghanistan plan announced last month envisions a greater role for regional players, including India. Kabul is the second stop for Mattis on a South Asia tour that began in New Delhi. During his stop in the Indian capital, Mattis praised India's invaluable contributions to Afghanistan and welcomed further efforts to promote Afghanistan's democracy, stability, and security. Mattis's Indian counterpart promised to strengthen cooperation with Kabul, although she ruled out sending any Indian troops there. These are among some of the top Asia stories that are trending on VOAnews.com. Secretary of State Tillerson heads to Beijing for talks on North Korea. War of words impedes complex North Korea diplomatic challenge. Fugitive former Thai Prime Minister Yingluck gets 5 years jail in absentia. Taiwan searching for new ways to connect with rival China. Bike boom nibbles on Asia gasoline demand growth. Expanded coverage of these stories and many more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said Wednesday his talks with Chinese officials on trade were frank and open, insisting the most important thing to push for is better market access for companies operating there physically and for companies exporting there. He said ranking equal with that would be less protectionist behavior. Ross was in Beijing to pave the way for President Donald Trump's scheduled visit in November and said he pressed Chinese officials on the need to rebalance bilateral trade and investment relations. Last year, the United States posted a nearly $350 billion trade deficit with China, accounting for about half of that. Julian Evans Pritchard is an economist with Capital Economics in Singapore. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the United States does have a case to make that the bilateral trading relationship is not on a level playing field, although it is more of a problem because of China's aggressive foreign trade and investment.
You now have a situation where Chinese firms, you know, obviously benefit from a much easier operating environment in the US. They have access to the same protections in terms of intellectual property, same access to financing as domestic players, whereas that's not always the case for foreign firms in China. This has helped to contribute to some degree to the economic imbalances between the two countries. One of the main sources of tension is all the implicit subsidies that the Chinese state firms have access to, which means that they can compete in ways that it's very difficult for American companies to compete. You know, one example is in heavy industry. Obviously, there's now significant overcapacity in sectors such as steel. That capacity would never have, you know, existed had it not been for preferential policies that these firms receive, so they could invest heavily, you know, subsidized credit, etc. And in many cases, you know, that capacity continues to exist because real budget constraints are not enforced on these firms. And China is now exporting a lot of that excess capacity to the rest of the world and making it difficult for firms in other countries to compete. You know, the difficulty is going to be convincing, you know, the Chinese to take big enough steps to really, you know, address these imbalances. There is a risk that the Chinese side only do as much as kind of necessary to achieve some kind of compromise and prevent relations from deteriorating.
When Chinese President Xi Jinping met with President Trump last April in the U.S., they agreed on a 100-day plan for trade talks to address some of the U.S. complaints about China's trade surpluses. Aside from a deal on U.S. beef into China, was there any real progress in your view?
You know, the progress has been quite limited. It was probably overly ambitious of them to expect to have sort of any large deliverables within a period of 100 days, because these are difficult issues to crack. The Chinese have now allowed some U.S. payment providers to enter the Chinese market as well. But, you know, these are pretty piecemeal. And that's kind of my concern in this whole progress. It seems that the Chinese side in particular are giving, you know, piecemeal concessions. The U.S. and Trump in particular can say that they've made progress.
Julian Evans Pritchard says that allows China to avoid taking the step that is really necessary, namely cutting or ending state support for Chinese enterprises. But he said there is progress elsewhere, including in foreign direct investment and a reduced list of industries where they're not allowed to operate in. Happening now in Asia, Thailand's Supreme Court convicted and sentenced former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra in absentia to 5 years in prison for mismanaging a rice subsidy scheme costing billions of dollars. Yingluck fled abroad last month, fearing military government would seek a harsh sentence. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happier with us today on VOA Asia. The United Nations Wednesday raised concern for the safety of Rohingya Muslim asylum seekers in Sri Lanka after Buddhist monks and hardline nationalists forced them to flee to a UN shelter in the capital, Colombo. The refugees, who were detained in April along with two suspected Indian human traffickers in a boat off of Sri Lanka's coast, are now in a camp in southern Sri Lanka to ensure their security after that incident in the capital. In Tuesday's incident, witnesses said the Sri Lankan monks and nationalists stoned the shelter, prompting its 31 Rohingya occupants, mainly women and children, to flee for their own safety. No injuries were reported, but this latest incident, combined with the exodus of hundreds of thousands of Muslim Rohingyas from Myanmar to Bangladesh, brings up many questions, one of which is the involvement of Buddhist monks in violent attacks on Rohingyas. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Dr. Michael Jerrison, Associate Professor of Religion at Youngstown State University in Ohio. Among Dr. Jerrison's books are Buddhist Warfare and Buddhist Fury. Ira asked Dr. Jerrison about the common belief that Buddhism is a religion of peace.
So if we look at the entire history of Buddhism, which is over 2,500 years, we see evidence of Buddhist traditions from all over, from whether it's Tibetan or Japanese or Burmese or Thai or Chinese, in which there are monks involved with violence, supporting violence or engaged in violence. So no tradition within Buddhism is bereft of these historical examples. And in fact, generally in a particular time period, it's when the state and Buddhism are more fused together or more prominent that we see these examples taking place. So in this current time period, Southeast Asia has a lot of Buddhist countries. We have Sri Lanka, we have Myanmar, we have Thailand, Cambodia. And so there are more Buddhist influenced states today in Southeast Asia than there are anywhere else in the world. And we've seen in the last 15, 20 years a lot of violence by Sri Lankan Buddhists, by recently Burmese Buddhists, and from Thai Buddhists.
Let's take Myanmar, Burma. Does the violent segment of Buddhist monks have more of an influence on the government? And I'm speaking of Aung San Suu Kyi as well, or the military, or both?
At present, it seems as though the Buddhist groups have more influence over Aung San Suu Kyi's government than the military. And I say this because the ways in which these Buddhist nationalistic organizations have been able to push forward their policies and the reticence in which Aung San Suu Kyi's government has showed to critique or criticize Buddhist monks who have been pushing forward vitriolic attacks against Muslims. So in terms of popular opinion or in terms of influences throughout Myanmar, it's been the Buddhist organizations that have been distributing leaflets, flyers, videos, again, underscoring what they think is the dangers of Islam and dangers of Muslims. And they're not alone. A lot of Buddhist nuns have been the most vocal of the fear of Islam. And so when you have a large amount of people who are highly respected, like Buddhist monks, talking about this fear and the fear they think of Buddhism being threatened, it has a lot of other Buddhists in Myanmar support. And you've got over 88% of the country is Buddhist.
You see a way out of this?
My concern is that we're going to see here in Myanmar what we saw in Sri Lanka. And by that, I mean, from 1983 to 2009, there was a 26-year civil war between the Sri Lankan Buddhist government and the LTTE, which was largely an ethnic group, Tamils, that were majority Hindu and Christian. Now, Buddhist groups, Buddhist monks, pushed the government not to compromise, not to negotiate with the LTTE, and in the end, the government lay waste to the LTTE, demolished them completely after 26 years. And that's how they resolved the situation. And there wasn't enough international intervention to stop this. And my fear has been that this is what's happening in Myanmar right now.
It's a religious war, is what you're saying. It's nothing new. It's been happening for centuries, right?
We are seeing a state that is being heavily influenced by religion, discriminating and engaging in violence against a significant portion of their population. So, yes, I mean, this is where I think religion is unmistakably in the mix. And whenever religion is involved in a conflict, it changes the ways that you can diffuse that conflict. Meaning that if the issue is money or land, then you negotiate land or money. But it's hard to negotiate the sacred. Powerful influence that a monk has. They have an authority that would be equivalent in the United States, for example, to citing the Bible. They don't need to cite Scripture. What they say is, in fact, Scripture. So when you have a high-ranking monk like Uwerthu saying that these Rohingya Muslims are like African fish that breed quickly and eat their own. This is not just simply a view of a monk, but this is a religious sanctioned authority providing justification for seeing people a certain way.
Dr. Michael Jerrison is Associate Professor of Religion at Youngstown State University in the U.S. state of Ohio. Among his books, Buddhist Warfare, Buddhist Fury. Thank you so much for being with us.
Dr. Jerrison had much more to say. You can hear the full interview with Ira Melman on VOA Asia Facebook. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Hours after U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis arrived in Afghanistan, a rocket attack on Kabul airport killed one person and wounded several others. Islamic State claimed responsibility, as did the Taliban, saying the attack was aimed at Mattis's plane. Mattis was not near the airport at the time. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As we continue now with VOA Asia, brick. A simple slab of baked clay has been a vital building material around the world for millennia. But traditional brick-making methods produce pollution that threatens health and the climate. As VOA's Steve Barragona reports, better, cleaner methods exist, but the industry is poorly regulated, and change is a challenge.
Roughly 300 billion bricks per year come out of kilns across South Asia. In India alone, this one industry creates nearly 10% of the country's soot, a health hazard and a potent contributor to climate change. Nearly all of the kilns follow one basic design, according to Sachin Kumar at India's Energy Research Institute.
The existing technology of brickmaking in India is bolt strength kiln, which is highly polluting and energy consuming.
The bolt strength kiln dates back to the 19th century. The Energy Research Institute and others have been promoting another method, which uses a zigzag kiln, named for the way the air moves through the bricks.
So this technology of zigzag kiln is better than the bolt strength kiln, not only in terms of energy performance, but also in terms of environmental emissions.
Kumar says black carbon emissions from the zigzag kiln are about 75% lower, and it uses 15 to 20% less fuel. That saves owners money, a good reason to switch. But experts say lack of information, weak regulation, and poor enforcement are barriers to change. For starters, authorities generally do not know where all the kilns are located. But Stanford University researchers are working on a way to map them from space. Stephen Luby saw the kiln's smoke plumes while flying over India.
So then I got thinking, well, wait a minute. If I can do this sitting in a plane, we must be able by remote satellite to detect these as well.
Luby's team used high-resolution data from a European satellite. They combined visual imagery with a kiln's heat signature, says research assistant Abhilash Sundar Raj.
Our algorithm actually detects these kilns very well. In fact, in the small district we were looking at, it found brick kilns which the ground team did not find during their data collection.
Mapping is just the first step. Redesigned kilns may be cheaper to operate, but retrofits cost money up front. Luby's team plans to study incentives for owners to change. And owners need technical help too, notes Sachin Kumar.
Apart from the financial challenge, I think one of the major issue for the existing entrepreneur will be availability of the local service providers, because they are the one who can help him, who can guide him in adopting the zigzag technology.
It's a big job. Across South Asia, there are tens of thousands of bull's trench kilns to retrofit. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
This news alert from VOA Asia, a new opinion poll by social weather stations, says more than half of Filipinos surveyed believe police unjustly killed many people arrested in the government's anti-drug crackdown. 54% surveyed said many of those killed by police did not really put up resistance. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, U.S. home builders created more than a million units of housing in 2016, according to the Census Bureau. Often older homes are demolished to make way for new buildings, and things like doors, floors, windows, and more get thrown away. Arash Arabasadi reports from Washington on one nonprofit that reclaims old materials and gives back to the community.
This house is getting a makeover.
We're going to take this thing down to the studs and then put in a new reflected ceiling plan, new kitchen, all new bathrooms and flooring throughout the house.
But there's a twist. Instead of throwing away the old materials, the owners receive a tax break by giving them to the nonprofit group Community Forklift.
So if you're a homeowner, and let's say you donate your cabinets and all your appliances, and they're in really good condition, whatever the value, the market value of those products are, the homeowner takes that on their tax returns.
So the homeowner gets a benefit, and so do those in the community who are less fortunate.
not about extracting resources and keeping them for ourselves. For us, it's really part of partnering in the community. So folks need a refrigerator or a stove or paint or whatever it is, they can come in here and they can get it for free.
For free. With help from Community Forklift, a local nonprofit called the Youth Entrepreneur Institute was able to repurpose an old house into a place that helps keep more than 300 kids off the streets.
When we first came upon this place, it was a big mess. So Community Forklift was nice enough to say, hey, we'll work with you guys and build a relationship with you guys to build the place out the way we want it to look.
So Community Forklift provided building materials and paint at a total cost of $0.
Without Community Forklift, we would not be able to get any of this done.
They turned little profit, though. Meyer says Community Forklift generated revenue of about $2 million in 2016. That money goes back into the company, where the 50 or so employees all earn more than the federal minimum wage. The company looks to expand its warehouse in the future, putting more good back into the community. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Home supplies and even those that have been recycled mean little to people without a home. Homelessness is a serious problem, and there are a variety of approaches to combating it. Faith Lapidus has the story of one effort to tackle the problem in Los Angeles, one tiny house at a time.
This is not your typical construction crew. These 9, 10, and 11-year-olds are helping Elvis Summers build a tiny house for a homeless veteran.
Today, we are going to start building some of the trusses.
The project grew from a class assignment to create a scale model for a sustainable small house.
When the school reached out to me and said that the 4th and 5th grade class want to build a house, I was completely excited. And they said, well, we want to build it a little bigger than, your normal size. And it's like, yeah, let's do it.
Summers has built more than 36 tiny houses for homeless people in Los Angeles during the past 2.5 years, starting with a woman named Smokey.
She was 60 years old and lived in my neighborhood and slept in the dirt. And everyone in the neighborhood knew her, liked her, but didn't seem to care that she was face first on the ground at night. And that just got to me. I was like, people are so busy in this world, So I decided to build her a tiny house.
The house he and the students are building is a bit bigger, 8.5 by 2.5 meters. About 135 kids have been helping, working in shifts during the school year.
The kids have been 100% engaged. It's been so nice because I don't think they realized how big this was going to be and how it was going to progress. So it was cool. Like, we started with the foundation, and then once the wall started coming up, you could just see their faces like, oh my gosh, we're really doing this.
In the process, they're learning teamwork and valuable construction skills.
I am amazed. I'm just like, since we just had just a trailer, and then we work on the floors, and we work on the walls, and then it's so amazing seeing it all come together.
And it is all coming together for someone who needs it.
It's amazing that we get to build a house for someone that has helped our country. And it's kind of cool to get this experience that not much people get.
When it's completed, this house will probably be placed in a mobile home park. And Summers will start on the next one.
Nobody anywhere should be homeless, let alone in one of the richest countries in the world.
There are about 58,000 people living on the streets of Los Angeles, and Summers is doing what he can to lower that number. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And there's some great video that we've built around many of these stories that you've heard on our program, and when you have the time, go check it out. You can see these stories at our Facebook page, VOA Asia, and on our website, voanews.com. You've been listening to VOA Asia. We invite you to write to us through our Facebook page at VOA Asia, or you can send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. We thank everyone in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, who joined us today via Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur. We'd also like to say a special hello to the Faculty of Communication who run the radio station. We thank, too, the folks who are running ours, Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Jim Harmon, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, David Bird, Ira Melman on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a super day.